Oh boy.
Hello.
No.
Where are you from?
I'm not part of this. I shouldn't have to. I don't want to tell you that. No. Sorry. No.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 252 for the week of May 20th, 2019. I am Fox, who has become the hunter, David T. Cole, and I'm here with falsely accused hairdresser, Sarah D. Bunting.
It's French.
Hot priest, Tara Ariano.
Neil.
And somber bassoonist, Jeff Drake.
Where's Claire?
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Joining us is our dear old friend Jeff Drake. Hello, Jeff.
Hello.
Jeff.
Hi.
Yay!
We are here to talk about the second season of Fleabag, which has just dropped on Amazon. And fair warning for everyone listening, we have all watched the whole season. We are going to talk about the whole season. If you haven't watched the whole season by now, maybe you don't love Phoebe Waller-Bridge as much as you should, I feel.
Right.
I'm just kidding. I understand people have other things to do, I guess. But anyway, Fleabag season two. People may have feared it could not be as good as season one. Surprise. I felt it was even better. Really had a more, I guess it's not fair to say a more ambitious story, but certainly a very different one. Jeff, what are your high level impressions of season two of Fleabag?
I 100% agree with that. I would say that it is more ambitious. It goes into the season like really establishing brand new rules, and then like it was shockingly good. I mean, it's just really like I loved season one so much, and I didn't know what to expect from season two, and it was just like it was so easy. It was hard not to watch the entire thing in like one sitting. It's so good.
Yeah, we did watch it all in one sitting and then watched it again for the podcast. Sarah D. Bunting, this season we have a new character, a hot priest that Fleabag gets a crush on, and then some more. How did you think he was? How did he mesh with the cast? What were your feelings about him?
I thought that Andrew Scott, Father Moriarty, was actually perfect casting for this because he, like, he is very charming, but not too.
Mm-hmm.
He is sort of like he seems lost, but isn't, which sort of makes a good inverse for Fleabag, who seems like maybe she's not lost, but she still is. And it was really I think it was a tricky thing to bring in, you know, a religious figure and have that be like extremely literal in some ways, and having him sort of deal with her and her family. And her, like, grief and wandering that she's not dealing with, that she's still, I think, suppressing. But the show pulls it off. Like, it really, because it's so good at pulling off these, you know, connecting on these big swings that it does, you don't necessarily realize, like, what risks it's taking or how badly it could go.
Yeah.
But he and like for a character that ambitious and tricky, I think that he was a perfect choice. I thought he was great. And I thought that storyline was like, wow, are they really going to go there? But then, as usual, because it works, you're not like put off by the ambitiousness of it. And it doesn't seem like it's for its own sake. It seems organic. I assume you guys were on board with this and more aspect of the priest and
oh yeah, I loved it. I mean, I loved how it started in a sort of like a very sitcom-y cliche, like, ooh, I have a crush on a hot priest. It's so transgressive. And then it deepens into very quickly. You can tell, I mean, not that anyone thought it was going to go to, you know, a multicam place with it, but you know, right away in the second episode we see Fleabag going to church and she just wants to be around him, and she's trying to figure out like exactly what it is she thinks she's doing with this guy. And then the more she gets to know him and the more she sees how dorky he is, like, and then what I thought was interesting about this, the way they handled it, two things. One, that they have her do the usual TV or pop culture thing of like a secular person asking a priest or any kind of clergy person, like, don't you ever have doubts, as though the rest of us in our various like jobs or life experiences, like, are going around all the time without doubts, you know, like people have this sort of like built in expectation, like, well, if you've chosen this life, you know, it must be something you have to keep choosing, as if that's not true of everybody all the time. But the other thing that I especially loved was that as the more time they spend with each other, as she keeps kind of glancing at the camera or at us, you know, and doing her kind of Shakespearean asides, he at a certain point is in that bubble with her and she is freaked out by it. But at the same time, it's like, that's in a way how it feels when you click with a person romantically or otherwise, that you do feel like you're sort of in that bubble, you know, with them. Dave, we just celebrated our 22nd wedding anniversary. Don't Yay. You agree?
Yeah, that bubble's great.
I mean, talking about that, like him noticing her asides, I didn't really look at it, although I agree with what you just said about like that shows him inside her bubble.
Yeah.
As like, this is like a huge swing. Like, it's also tied into like when she's at the therapist and she says, I have friends.
Yeah.
And she looks at the camera as if to say, you guys are my friends,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is a kind of a cool thing, but also super sad. Mm-hmm. like, cause what is our relationship? Like on the meta level of this show, like what is going on? Like this acknowledgement of us watching her mm-hmm. is like in all of the shows that use any kind of asides to the camera, like this is like a really kind of weird, like additional, like turn it up to 11 kind of moment of like, what does it mean when a character is doing this? Mm-hmm. And then that he can see it takes on like this spiritual level, affirms or confirms his like level of faith, and that like he can see through that, like he sees through that device or something, like it's some sort of weird divine sort of level like it achieves. And it just like
he's seeing through some sort of veil, whatever that means.
Yeah. I mean, although the very final shot is sort of like her acknowledging, like, I no longer need this.
Mm-hmm. Or I no longer want it. Maybe she does still need it. I mean, one or the other.
Yeah, no, I think that's a better point. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, there were two unseen characters this season too. Us, she keeps talking to.
Yeah.
And God, who also keeps making himself known in various ways, which I thought was also an interesting runner for Father. He never gets a name like all of the characters other than Claire.
Yeah. both Claires.
Yeah, both of them. Right. Both Claires that he keeps interacting with, or, you know, acknowledging that God is also watching the same as we are, except not the same. I like that too.
The whole season is like such a gigantic swing by like really taking seriously faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but in a way that's not like preachy or whatever, a way that's very realistic. Like, does he have doubts, you know, and all of that. And it's like, he's this very realistic and he's very pragmatic. He's like, yeah, I curse and all of this. And, you know, it's the type of like serious treatment of religion that actually right now what it occurs to me is like sort of the same sort of approach that like of respect towards religion that weirdly Book of Mormon has, if you've ever mm-hmm. seen Book of Mormon, where it's like, oh, this seems like they're just going to fucking take the piss out of Mormonism. But it's like, no, this is a show about like why we have faith and how faith works and how faith is actually kind of great.
Well, it's not about the tenets of faith. It's just about what it does for you as a human.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is the more important aspect. All of that said, all of this heady stuff out, it is such a funny season. It is.
Mm-hmm.
Where like, I feel like season one was like super funny and then like got very like in a good way, like serious and dark by the end, like, you know, kind of ended on this, like, oh my God, that was tragic kind of ending. This sort of lives in that tragedy is just kind of like a heartbeat behind everything. And, you know, it's like this, you know, like she actually has changed, you know, but then like, there's just so much. That's just so fucking hilarious.
But the highlight for that, for me, for some reason, on second watching, was in episode two, where they meet the lawyer who Claire has introduced them to in order to defend her against Claire's husband's upcoming lawsuit or whatever is going to happen there. And he is having a meeting in their office, legs up on the table, eating this sandwich or burger, and like there's special sauce all over his mouth. And he's just like such a devil may care sort of attitude towards everything, the law, relationships, just everything that's happening in his life. It is just like such a weird floaty moment that tickled me.
I was glad Sarah brought up the falsely accused hairdresser, because that scene made me die. Sarah, do you want to talk some more about that?
Oh my
so
God.
Well handled.
So Claire calls Fleabag in a complete panic, like having a meltdown. And Fleabag is like on it, but she's also sort of secretly thrilled that totally controlled Claire is having a meltdown and needs her. And she's gotten this asymmetrical bob that, I mean, she can get away with it, but she's like, she's having a complete meltdown.
She looks like a Romulan from Star Trek.
Yeah. She does. Yeah. That's a very good point.
What is the hairdresser's name?
Antony.
And apparently this is one of the things that the show does so well. They're like, Antony again? Really? All right, that's it. Like, we're going to confront him. And there's like sort of years of history that you can just imagine in that reference, which is like never followed up. And that's, I don't know, that's great writing in my opinion, that you can just fill in from what you already know.
Yeah.
Their travails with Antony.
She reads him for, you know, hair. He says it's only hair. It's not that important. Fleabag says it is important. We wish it wasn't, so we could think about something else for once in a while, but it really is. This isn't what she asked for. And Antony sends his assistant to get the reference paper. She silently digs it out of the trash, and it is precisely what Claire has on her head.
Like, I feel like they were like, I'll show you that it was wrong, and then it's like, oh
yeah, no, it was Claire who's like, get the reference paper.
Get the reference. And it's like, oh, sorry, we're very sorry.
And then the last line of the scene is Fleabag saying to Antony, I'll see you next week. Like, that to me is like such the perfect button for exactly the reason that Sarah said. It's like, there is all this history. It does not need to be spelled out. But the bottom line is they still both go to Antony, like, even though they know they shouldn't. He's still the best.
Well, and he has a great line, like her rant about, like, you know, hair actually is important and, you know, it shouldn't be, but it is. Is followed up by him being like, look, if you want to change your life, change your life. But it's not like, that's not what I'm here for.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty amazing that, you know, they can make these sort of big pronouncements that are fairly abstract, and it still works. Like, Claire's now ex-husband, I guess, spoiler, like his big sort of pitch to her at the wedding, and like, you know, but you might not like me, but you love me. Like, all of these things that seem like they would be things that, like, you write down on post-it notes, and it's like, I got to work that into a project sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they get worked in and feel completely natural. Like, that, I mean, that actor is amazing and not vain at all. But then another thing I like about it and the show in general is that it's content to let darkness and hilarity like occupy the same space and not say anything about the proportions or what's appropriate about that. Like, he has he knows that he's losing Claire, his heart is breaking, and then he has this hilarious bit about why the bassoon, why? that was just like, I had to pause it because it's like, I think that this is an important speech, but also just the delivery of why the bassoon was, because really, why the bassoon? But that's one of the things that I like.
Cry for help.
Yes.
I mean, on that same topic, like the speech that the lesbian businesswoman gives about women carrying pain is like a tremendously great, insightful, like awesome speech, but that it's also like that can live inside this and not seem like Aaron Sorkin-y or whatever, you know, like where it's like, I'm about to make a very important pronouncement or what, you know, it's just like, she's so good at what she does. Like, it's one of the few things, like, and I watch it with my wife and she's like, I don't really get professional jealousy, but like seriously, like, mm-hmm. how does she do that? Like, what, like, she's so good. I wish I could, like, you know, she wrote 12 like perfect episodes.
Yeah.
And then she stopped. Bless her. Bless her.
Well, she basically stopped after 6 and wasn't going to do anymore, you know, and then it took a while for her to, like, you know, it's crazy. It's crazy. There's not like a down moment. Like, the first episode of this season, somebody needs to submit that for the canon, because that is one of the best episodes of television. It plays like a one act play.
Yep.
There's so many balls in the air and there are so many surprises, and somebody needs to give an award to the actress who plays the waitress, because it's a work of art.
Yeah. It's spectacular. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder too, if the decision to do it was that this is also Fleabag's Jesus year. And like, this is Phoebe Waller-Bridge's take on like what that means for this character and for this world. But before we move on to whatever we're going to talk about next, since you said Sarah has no vanity, do you want to talk a little bit about Olivia Colman this season as Godmother? Oh.
This woman's craft, oh my God, like, she is terrible. Like, she turned up the terribleness, because I had said before that the way that she's written and performed is pitched very carefully, so that she is exactly that kind of territorial, obnoxious step person.
Uh-huh.
But it never goes too far, so that it's like not realistic. And you're like, well, look, even a British person would have kicked her in the tits by now. she does notch it up a little bit, but there was one particular moment that I was like, I mean, everyone else needs to just cease acting, because the most perfect acting has now occurred. I believe it's a flashback to the funeral.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'll leave you two alone. And then she has that fatuous smile, and she's standing there waiting for exactly the right amount of time for one of them to be like, oh no, that's okay, stay, which they do not do. And she's just standing there
forever.
And then finally she's like, and leaves. This character is just perfectly realized on all fronts. Oh, awful. But then he, you know, sort of goes ahead with it. And I like that the dad's sort of, you know, discussion with Fleabag about it and his getting his foot stuck in a hole. Like, there's not that cinematic sort of progress or closure or realization. Like, that's not life.
Yeah.
Old dudes just, you know, stand where they're told to a certain extent, and everyone involved realizes that. And I thought it was really good. But I mean, Colman, international treasure, and that moment was amazing.
She manages to deliver the line, this is my very interesting friend Daniel, who's deaf, with like an absolutely deadpan straight face, fishing for credits among the crowd.
And then she makes the fluttering motion with her hands that is supposed to approximate sign language, and
she doesn't know what any of it means.
Yeah.
She just loves, she's like, isn't that entertaining that deaf people do this with their hands, basically? It's the craziest. And then like later, she's introducing her soon to be husband, and you find out she really doesn't know his first name.
I just always call you darling.
Oh my God. It's okay. So hilarious.
Yeah, I feel like her whole character was building to, like, if for no other reason, they can't do another season because she will never top, like, just being in her element at her wedding, introducing all her frightfully interesting friends to each other that she's collected, obviously, very self-consciously over the years for precisely a moment such as this. Like, it's just, as Sarah said, so well observed, brilliant, amazing.
Yeah.
I will also add just very quickly, so much of TV does not understand, like, is everyone in writers' rooms only children? Have you never been around adult siblings?
Oh my God.
This show is not that. Like, this is absolutely a documentary of how grown-up siblings deal with each other, and it's great.
Yep. Yeah. It's a perfect show. I mean, that feels like hyperbole, and yet it definitely is. It's a perfect show. Everyone should watch it.
Yep.
It is time to go around the dial. First stop, Tara Ariano.
Okay, this is my fault, because I said tweet me about my dad wrote a porno, and thousands of you did. Not thousands, but a lot. I really have gotten more tweets about my dad wrote a porno than almost anything else. First of all, stop. I get it. Second, Emily was wrong. The dad is not dead. He is alive and is on Twitter. And they apparently, in order to keep the podcast going, may have like commissioned him to write more pornos past the original one that was, according to the official story, like found in his shed. I still doubt he really wrote them. I feel like this is a shit my dad says situation, where like maybe there's a germ of truth to it, but it was like hugely embellished for the purpose of making money. Anyway, point being, I'm never going to listen to this podcast. Please don't tweet me about it anymore. I'm very happy that you all have found it, and evidently it has brought you so much joy.
Absolutely. Don't tweet her at Tara Ariano.
Dave. Right.
No, what? Do not do that.
I am here to talk about Vita, which is a half-hour dramedy on Stars, returning this week for its second season. And much as they did with Now Apocalypse, Stars is going to put up the whole season on their app at once, and then also air episodes weekly. In this case, they're going to air two at a time every Sunday night. So Vita is a show that premiered last year. It's about two sisters, Emma and Lynn, who come back home because their mother has passed away. She owns a bar, and then the building, so the apartments above as well. She's passed away. They come back for her funeral and find out a lot of things in a very short period of time, including that their mother was married to a woman, which they didn't know she was any kind of gay at all. Never mind in a committed relationship with this person, and left her a third of the estate. So the three of them have to share it. The business was hugely in trouble. It's set in East LA in a slowly gentrifying formerly Latino neighborhood. So there's a lot of stuff around that. She took out a lot of mortgages, so they're also in debt. And the person that she took the mortgages out from is basically just waiting for them to fail so that he can buy the building and convert it into fancy condos and do the typical gentrifying stuff. It's another really good, I'm glad that you said that last about siblings, Sarah, because this is also an excellent sibling show. The older sister, Emma, has moved further away. She was in Chicago. She seemed to do something in finance or business or something, and was, you know, doing very well, living in a very fancy life. Her sister is a little bit more of a free spirit. She just moved to San Francisco and has been kind of like sleeping with a succession of guys who have been taking care of her in various ways. And now they are, by the end of the first season, decide to stay and try to make a go of the business. And so that's where we pick up with them in season two, except now there's more revelations about Eddie, the mother's wife, and the real state of the business and their various romantic relationships with the people that they, you know, in some cases grew up with, and new people, and, you know, as these things go. There's a lot of political stuff that's going on about gentrifying, but also just about, you know, who is gente and who isn't, and what it means to be, like, you know, more assimilated into white culture. Emma keeps being mistaken for white, and it's annoying every time. But the guy who played Richie in Looking is in season two. He's playing a handyman. I love that guy. It's a really great show. And if you have Stars, you have the Stars app. So put it on your Apple TV. You can watch all 10 episodes, all back to back to back. And Sarah, I'm going to mention especially for you, some really great dangling earring action, at least in the first three episodes, which is all I've watched so far. So if you wanted to watch it just to shop it, I think you will not be disappointed. It's a really good show. It was like super under the radar, but deserves more attention. So I hope it gets some.
You know me for sure.
For my plug, I wrote a who's who among the hot young dudes of the Catch-22 miniseries adaptation on Hulu, which has, at the time you read this, has dropped last Friday. So we'll link it in the show notes, but you can find that at primetimer.com. You're welcome. They're hot.
Jeff Drake.
As a person who has children, I want to address a couple of things, and this also will come into play later in this podcast. First of all, it's sad. I have a sad note to report, which is I have an 8-year-old son. He will soon be 9, which means that as of the CBS upfronts, he has still never lived in a world that did not include Blue Bloods. And it's an upsetting truth that I have to live with, and I just want to share that with the world.
That's why also, you named him Blue Bloods.
I shouldn't have named him Blue Bloods. Shouldn't have named him Tom Selleck Jr.
I mean, you should.
Shouldn't have named him Marky Mark's brother. Anyway, I don't know. You know, I'll punch up these jokes later, and then I'll send them in. Anyway, so my son watches, like, for a while, it was nothing but Pokemon. And if you've never watched the Pokemon TV show, there's, like, 30 seasons of it, and every season has 90 episodes. There are an infinite number of Pokemon episodes, and the same thing happens every time. But then he got off of it and was trying to watch something else that was sort of like adventure-y and exciting, and he landed on She-Ra, the new She-Ra, which I remember all of the stink about. I never watched the original when I was a kid because I was a little older than the Target demo. And I remember all the fucking fanboys being up in the having their fucking panties in a bunch because it's like basically like, how can I masturbate to this new She-Ra? Right.
This She-Ra is not fuckable enough.
This She-Ra, like, how dare you make a female cartoon character that I cannot imagine like going down on me. And it is like, which is like, it's so bananas that like, first of all, I was like, who ever cared about She-Ra and why are you mad? But also then like, okay, setting that aside, the show is really pretty great. And like, and especially from like the female characters are all really terrific. And like, instead of like in Pokemon where all the women are like sticks with giant boobs, that they're just like regular looking women, like young women. And so it's like, I feel like I'm like thrilled in a way that like my son is like watching this show that is basically like it's the majority of the characters are female characters, and it's a very interesting show and entertaining and really kind of clever and snarky. And if you've got kids, it's a great thing for kids to watch. He's 8, going to turn 9, and it's kind of right in that pocket. You could probably be a little bit younger and still enjoy it. But like it's a really terrific show to watch, and keep them away from Pokemon, even though there's a deluge of them out there. And then as far as plugging, I will just say that not soon, but in 2020, you'll be able to see a really terrific show that I've been writing on. And if you happen to think of the famous park in New York and like Google that, and then like people like Kristen Bell and Josh Gad's name drop into that Google search also, ooh, you will find information about this show, which also has Stanley Tucci and David Diggs and
dang.
And who am I leaving out? Titus Burgess and Leslie Odom Jr.
Dang.
And maybe it's a musical also. I don't know. Guys.
My God.
Guys, it's really like you can't really – who knows? Just – I mean, if you Google it, you might find out information about it. But
okay.
Technically, it's kind of – I'm kind of not supposed to talk about it. But it's going to be great. It's from the producer of Bob's Burgers. Lauren Bouchard is one of the co-creators of it, along with Nora Smith and also Josh Gad. And it's terrific, and it'll be on one of the Apple streaming shows in 2020.
That's very exciting.
Hey.
We're waiting for that to drop. I believe there's something else you've been writing on that we can watch in the meantime.
Well, you could watch I wrote on I'm Sorry Season 2. You could watch, I believe it's probably streaming somewhere. It's True TV. Mm-hmm. And that was a very fun season and fun stuff with Andrea Savage and Tom Everett Scott. Tom Everett Scott, one of the nicest human beings you could ever meet.
You love to hear it. So
He did such a great job playing a dick smack governor on SVU back in the day.
Oh, really? So that's great. He really, honestly, couldn't be more delightful. Like, he's a real, just like married his like high school bunch of girls. He's just like, aww. It's like the, it's kind of like a being an actor is like inconvenient. It's a thing to like, kind of gets in the way of, you know, me being a dad or whatever. He's terrific. Anyway, the show is very funny, and it was fun to work on, and check it out.
Woo!
Sarah D. Bunting.
This is a side note, but Tom Everett Scott, I used to work for a photo blog many, many years ago, and Tom Everett Scott was the victim/subject of my all-time favorite headline. Some paparazzo shot him. He was just like out shopping for shoes. They shot him from like knee level. He was wearing extremely tight pants and these like Unabomber glasses. So I wrote, "I'd like to report a suspicious package. Thank you. Thank you very much."
Nice.
If you need to at me, that's at Tara Ariano.
Oh, thanks.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm actually here to talk about a documentary that's airing on Showtime on May 31st. It is called Quiet Storm, the Ron Artest story. Ron Artest, who changed his name to Meta World Peace in 2011, was a very good, possibly great NBA player who unfortunately was almost as well known during his career for having anger management issues and for one notorious scuffle now known as the Malice at the Palace that got him suspended for an entire season when he went into the stands after a fan, which was justified because the guy threw a soda at him, but then he went after the wrong fan.
Ooh.
It became a whole thing.
Oh, right.
Quiet Storm is not an unpleasant hour and 45 minutes, but it's like both too long and too short. It's impressive that they got this actual fan who started this whole kerfuffle to sit for talking head interviews. And as it turns out, he and Artest/World Peace are friends now. They get Jermaine O'Neal, who is the captain of the Pacers when Artest was on that team, talking about, like, I mean, this was sort of like the depth of Artest's struggles, let's say. And O'Neal is talking at length about why he had issues with the behavior and that he's still, like, offended and hurt by certain ways Artest chose to be. But the film... I mean, it's directed by a guy named Johnny Sweet, okay, who has directed exactly one other thing, which is on Michael Vick, and they were both produced by Bleacher Report. The movie is marketed with a connection to Mental Health Awareness Month, and that is great. And World Peace's openness about his battles with neurochemical challenges is great, too, but the documentary is pretty cagey about what exactly Artest suffers from. It's not like necessary for him to go into super detail, but it's also like if part of your marketing is that we need to be more open and destigmatize mental illness, then maybe be a little more specific, like at all.
Right.
They put chyrons like that are quotes from the psychologist that he's been going to for years, and he like thanked her on camera after he won an NBA title, but she's not in the film except for that. The movie is content to blame part of Artest's problems on mental illness inherited from, among others, his father, but then it doesn't really examine too closely that his father was physically abusive in the service of furthering Artest's basketball talents. It thinks that showing a press conference at which he wept while apologizing is all it needs to say about the domestic violence incident for which he was sorry, which it's not that I don't believe he regretted it, but that felt inappropriately timid to me. Mm. Either we're exploring these issues of mental illness and its stigmatization in the pro sports community, or the lack of access to appropriate care for all but the wealthy and the ripple effect that this has. Or we're not. And what we're not so much doing in Quiet Storm either is talking about the way in which Artest's behavior tended to be received and discussed at the time, by which I mean white sports writers.
Yeah.
as well as that fucking gas bag, Bill Walton, who, until he can get through an entire shot clock without plugging some goddamn thing on the play-by-play, let's not ask him anything else about anything and do not at me. Anyway, white sports writers murmuring then and now that it's, quote, unforgivable to go into the stands after a fan. I just feel like the way pro athletes of color who are obviously unwell or struggling with depression or anxiety or whatever it is, I feel like the coverage of that is very different.
Yeah. I would just break in here for a second to say you can also see Shut Up and Dribble, the 4-part documentary series on Showtime, which goes into a lot more detail on this. I mean, obviously they have more space to, but it's better on this than it sounds like Quiet Storm is.
Yeah, I just felt like this needed to be either like a 30 for 30 that was 48 minutes long only on this like specific brawl and various things leading to and away from it, or it needed to be a longer series about Artest. And the fact is, like, if, you know, when Terrell Owens was taken to the hospital for overdosing on hydrocodone, people were mad at him for showboating. Like, this for pro athletes of color is like a serious issue on its own, and also the way that it's discussed, like, sans empathy. Like, no one would talk about Gronk like that, let's face it. Anyway, Artest / World Peace is a fascinating guy, but Quiet Storm isn't great. You might be better off just finding the footage of Artest's press conference after the Lakers won in 2010, because it's really charming. Like, he's super excited in this childlike way that is amazing. But that is called Quiet Storm. Showtime, May 31st. Mixed review from me. What did not get a mixed review, here comes my plug, is our Mastass episode on Katie Lang's version of Hallelujah, which we asked on our Instagram if that was the definitive version, and Katie Lang stepped into the comments to be like, there is no definitive version, that's the point. We were like,
ma'am,
and tried not to faint. So anyway, Mark and Sarah talk about songs. Last week it was Katie Lang. This coming week we're talking about Fergie. God help us. So yes, you can download that wherever you find podcasts, and our Instagram will be linked in the show notes.
Woo-hoo. All right, everybody, it is time for the canon. Just before I start it, I just want to say there's only one clip in this canon, just the way that the author formed it. Didn't really need too many clips, but I wanted to add the one that's in there because I found it quite funny. So with that, here we go. This week's canon presentation.
Hello, extra hot, great crew. My name is Leanna. I turn 30 next year. I have no children, and I enjoy watching children's television programming. I swear I am not a deadbeat stoner. I don't drop acid and watch Fraggle Rock or anything like that. I find well-written kids' shows with realistic characters and valuable life lessons very hopeful. There is comfort in the idea of the next generation learning to be kind and smart and adventurous. I have chosen for my canon submission episode 2 of the Netflix show Hilda. Hilda is based on the award-winning British children's graphic novel series Hilda Folk, written and illustrated by Luke Pearson. The main character of the series is Hilda, a smart, independent adventurer with a very good outfit. She lives in the country with her awesome graphic designer mom in their awesome Nordic-style house. It's very IKEA, it's very Hygge, it's very hip, darling, it's very now. At the beginning of episode 2, titled Chapter 2, The Midnight Giant, Hilda is embroiled in a permit battle with a nearby elf civilization. The elves love bureaucracy and paperwork, and they hate Hilda and her mom. And you can't see the elves until you sign the proper forms. Side note, the ridiculous mayor of this elf settlement has a tiny, tiny pet cat whose name is Angelina. In episode 1, Angelina is, quote, heavily pregnant and gives birth to tiny, tiny kittens in Hilda's hair, which explains the knittens at the beginning of episode 2. I originally wanted to submit both episode 1 and 2 for the canon, but I thought submitting a kid's show was already pressing my luck. But Sarah D. Bunting and other cat ladies like myself, please watch minutes 15 and 13 seconds to minutes 17 and 55 seconds in episode one for the pregnant Angelina clip. It's very cute and funny. Back to episode two, though. Hilda is also trying to solve the mystery of the lone giant that keeps appearing in the middle of the night. She gets help, sort of, from the woodman, a local spirit or creature who delivers unwanted firewood and barges in on Hilda and her mom without being invited. I love Woodman because where some shows might have a helpful fairy or a cutesy sprite or something, Hilda has sardonic Woodman, who honestly does not seem to give a fuck about her or her mom. Also, I love his house too.
Oh, you've let the Woodman in again.
I bet we wouldn't have neighbors like this in Trollberg.
Exactly my point. Civilized neighbors don't walk into your house without asking first.
But he's like part of our family.
No, I'm not. Can I have this when you move?
There are a lot of small things I want to mention that I enjoy about this show, like Hilda's pet deer fox, whose name is Twig. I want one so bad, you guys. I want a deer fox. It's so cute. Or an instance of what I call single mom side eye in a different episode, which I really appreciated. Or Hilda's future friend, David, who always has a bug on him. It's a running joke throughout the series. Someone will be talking to little David and they'll stop and they say, "You've got a ladybug on you," and it's cute. But in the interest of time, I will move on to the what the shit ending. Spoilers ahoy. By the end of the episode, Hilda has united her two giant friends that have been alternately seeking and waiting for each other. But as the giants walk off to begin their life of blissful giant union, they accidentally destroy Hilda's house. This serves the purpose of moving Hilda and her mom to the city of Trollberg, where Hilda meets new friends and starts new adventures. But I was shocked by the sudden destruction of her home at first. This can be a useful lesson, I guess, for younger viewers who are anxious about relocating. Hey, kid, moving is traumatic, but at least a giant didn't squoosh your house. It's important that the giants that unintentionally curb-stomp Hilda's home don't look back at what they have done. They are unaware of the damage that they have caused. It's kind of a fatalistic event for a kid's show to enforce the idea that sometimes bad things happen. Everything is impermanent. The last time I was here, the Midnight Giant says, there was no house. Not many children's shows encourage their audience to contemplate a time before they existed. Where is home? Where do I belong? Juvenile existential crisis time! But I feel these questions are not offered up in a mean-spirited way. We know that Hilda and her mom will be okay because they are together. The show provides a safe environment for kids to experience some scariness and adventure along with brave and empathetic Hilda. I am glad that the youth of today gets to have a hero like her. Thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you. And in case you were like me watching Hilda and you're like, what the hell is that voice? I put together this little guide for you.
This could be your school. Go ahead. Explore the playground.
Fine. But I'll keep a low profile.
Lord Kerwin, your father was skinned alive by Ramsay Bolton. Still, you refused the call.
Same actor.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice
lady,
one.
Lady Mormont.
The Lady Mormont. Let's start with Jeff. He chose it from the user submissions.
I had actually watched several episodes of this show right around the time, I guess, it dropped on Netflix. I don't know when, but like my son had read the first graphic novel, which in the American release is, I believe, called Hilda and the Troll. And it looks exactly the same and covers some of the same stuff. And it's really great. And so we started watching it and ended up watching a bunch of them. And then when I was rewatching it this morning, we just let it roll into episode after episode because this show is just – it's so delightful. Like the fact that the elves who are like very, very tiny are like all about bureaucracy and signing permits and is just such – like just it just like a real insight into where the show is coming from with all of these magical, mystical creatures. But like the best part about the show to me is the character of Hilda. Like, you've seen characters similar to her who are like brave and like, I'm going to figure this out or whatever. But there's like something fresh and real about the way that that she's sort of portrayed, the way that she's done, that doesn't seem like, you know, like it's trying to teach you a lesson about how you just have to like buckle down and get things done or whatever. I don't know. It's just it's such a terrific show. It's hard for me to be honest, to like sort of pull this episode aside and be like, should this, like, I feel like everybody should watch this series. It's so good. Like it's a yet another one. Like, I feel like good as a father with three sons, soon to be four. And to like that my oldest is like very into a lot of kid stuff that has female protagonists instead of just a bunch of like, you know, he also likes like the Percy Jackson books and stuff, but like he's also read the graphic novel Zeta the Space Girl and also Amulet, which both of those I highly recommend. But like Hilda is in there with like this really terrific central character. And then a lot, and then her mom is also like really, really terrifically drawn. Like all the characters are so, so interesting. And I do love the show. And I, like I said, I love just rolling into, oh, here's another episode. Here's another episode. And here's another episode. And I'm having a little bit of trouble, like, though, like this particular episode, I feel like I would like someone else to chime in about some of the specifics of the episode, because I'm kind of like hung up on how I feel about it as a canon submission a little bit.
I mean, I'm sort of having the same issue. I really enjoyed this episode. I thought that the mythology of these guardian giants was perfectly done in terms of that, like, not abstracted, but like that sort of grand vagueness with which old myths are told. But then at the end, when they're reunited and he's like, so wait, you waited 4,000 years for me? And she says, yep, which is a very unmythological way to put it. And then he's like, wow, which is also, and then they like jump into the sky together.
Yep.
And the way that she, like, she had sat down and then became this mountain. And then when she stands up and her, like, the snow cap is like her little tank top, it's just really like beautiful and clever and simple. But there are also so many, like, there's like an action sequence or two. And then there's like cute little moments. I also need a twig in my life. And the Nittens are adorable. And that she and her mom were just very matter of fact about like putting them in the box. And her mom's like, I think I got all of them. Like, what? Like, these are problems that I would not mind having. But it's also interesting that like Hilda, at least in this episode, is very focused on not wanting to move to Trollburg because she likes where she is. She doesn't want to be like hemmed in by a city and
school bell.
Yeah, she does have this like not peer group, but. When her mom's like, well, try out the playground. And she's like, she doesn't hate it. She's not miserable. She's not a misanthrope. But that's like sort of unusual, I think, for a protagonist to be like, I'd rather just sort of be here mostly on my own. Like just you and, you know, just you and me, mom, and various animals and imaginary creatures and their contracts. It's sort of unusual. But this was really like, you know, there were no slow patches. I really enjoyed it. And I did think that maybe there were some lessons to be learned, but we weren't being lectured. So, yeah, it was really neat and unexpected. But I mean, I only watched the one. I did want to watch more, which is one of my canon criteria. But I don't know if it's possible to pull one out that's better than others, so I will turn it over to Tara or Dave?
I'll go because I'll just jump off from what you were saying about her, Hilda, being reserved when she goes to the school. That dynamic between her and her mother, as a former only child of a single mother, definitely ran true to me, that there's a certain kind of, not precocity, but like it, when you spend time with one adult, mostly you definitely have more of an affinity with adults than you do. And you may be suspicious of other children, and especially someone like Hilda, who it seems like has been homeschooled or unschooled or something. Like she doesn't know what a school bell is. She finds it all very weird. I liked that detail, and I thought that was true to the single mother only child experience. But I love this too. It looks beautiful. The kind of two primary colors look of it reminds me of AP Bio, although there it's usually coral and gold versus blue and red as it was here. But the scandiness of the design, Woodman's house, I agree, adorable. Nittens, as soon as I saw that, I was like, well, that's for Buncey. Nice. Good choice.
Twig
is super cute. I mean, the design of all of the characters is great, but I feel like possibly the reason that Liana might have thought this would resonate with us, and the reason it resonate with me, is the character of the giant. I mean, anytime in a kid's program or otherwise that a large creature is sad, I find that very affecting.
I know.
He was very sweet. And you know, he was so resigned, and the design, that he hardly had a face. I mean, all of it was, I just loved it. He looks like a big hairy pickle with like no eyes. I mean, he's great. And I thought the, in terms of the lessons that are, you know, sort of being relayed in a very subtle way, the whole thing of the giant stepping on the house and destroying it. And then it's paralleled when, Hilda's mother steps on an elf house and destroys it and doesn't know because she can't see it. I mean, you know, to teach children to have an awareness of, you know, the things in the world that you can't see but might still affect, I think is important and a good thing to learn, and was handled in a very nice, subtle way. I thought it was great. I loved the presentation. I loved the episode. Dave, did you have more to add?
I thought, going to the animation style you were just talking about, I found it like a current reimagining of like Japanese animation, like from Studio Ghibli. Is that how you say it?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Ghibli.
That meets Scandinavian aesthetics, very clean and proper lines and everything. I thought it was a really amazing, clean look, and the color palette they used. And when they do the character designs, when their hair goes over the eyes, you can still see where their eyes are, which is an interesting choice that worked really well for expression. Especially with the mother and Hilda. I really like this episode. I thought it was both like cute and endearing. It doesn't have the obvious snap that like Steven Universe episode we talked about last month had, you know, where there's a core mission statement that's very front and center and everything points towards that, where this is more of an exploration of her world, and it sort of has this lazy river ride quality to it that I think is reflected in the setting and, you know, the relationships between her and the elves and how everything is just sort of like children's slow TV kind of vibe to it. I really responded well to that. I think after you watch it, the what the shit moment of the house being destroyed will have more impact. But I think just to think about it now that they established this world in two episodes, and then they move the whole show to the city on the third, is kind of a big thing to do for a kid's show. As she said in her presentation, just the impermanence of it all. The character designs are just amazing all through and through. The twig, the cat, deer creature, the woodman who looks like something from Super Mario Brothers 2, you know, when his head hovers over his body, looks like he's got a
Q-Birdie.
Yeah, he is kind of Q-Birdie. There's a lot to like in this episode. I do get that, you know, without the knowledge of being able to watch the whole series to make that determination, this episode over that episode. But I think this is going to be one of those shows that happens in the canon where it is a quality show that was planned in advance. Like, these are not procedural episodes. These are like, there's a throughput to this. The giant from the second episode makes an appearance in the first episode, sort of over the horizon. She has that first sighting of him. So when you have a show that has advanced planning that is set and they take their time with the story and they build things up and they go, you kind of like get this even keel phenomenon where it's a quality show throughout. And I think when that happens, what I just do is I will just say that this is the placeholder for sort of a canon season. And I've said it before and I'll say it again here. I think this is, you know, going to be one of those episodes that'll stand in for a 13-episode episode. You know, it's one story told.
The series is really, and I think we've watched like half of them, and the whole series has kind of a lazy river kind of thing. But and it's also like very interesting how like monsters are depicted, because it's almost like universally like the monsters are basically misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Like in almost every case, like there are different ones that sort of crop up, which is kind of an interesting take, instead of like having like a big like evil baddie or something that she has to like fight. And it's so like everything about the show is just really so fresh and just fun to watch. Like the look of it, it doesn't really look like any other show, you know, and just sort of thinking about it in those terms, like, you know, I really want people to experience the show because I think it's really terrific and people should watch terrific things and support terrific things.
Let us vote then.
All right. Let us do that. First of all, Jeff Drake.
Oh, gosh. Now I'm on the spot. No, I will vote yes for this.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting.
Middle age existential crisis time. Just kidding. Not really. I vote yes also.
Yes. And Tara Arianna.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm going to say yes too. This was very sweet. And if we have to, you know, by law, say what is it about episode two that makes it different, I think if nothing else, let's say that the house smash setting reset is sort of a bold move for a show that young kids are going to watch. And, you know,
that's
some good lessons there. All right, Hilda, season one, episode two, The Midnight Giant. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Juvenile existential crisis time.
Americans love a winner. Yeah. And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Sarah has our winner.
It's that sound drop, obviously. Additionally... It is our girl, Gabrielle Carteris, who is seeking re-election as SAG-AFTRA president, and we wish her good luck. I have a SAG member in my household, and I will lean on him to support her candidacy.
And loser of the week?
Relatedly, well, it's the production of the Beverly Hills 90210 reboot, which is being called BH90210. A bunch of its writers have quit this week, including the showrunner. This thing is supposed to premiere on August 7th. Like, I kind of feel like it should be mostly written by now, but apparently at issue is diva behavior from two of its actresses. We can probably make an educated guess as to who those two are because two of them have a production company together, cough. But good luck to everyone. I'm going to throw it to you because your analogy yesterday about what this thing is going to probably be was so perfect and I don't want to steal it from you. Sarah.
Me? Oh, yeah. Wow. It was so perfect that it vanished.
Sarah said so she felt like this was going to be like Snakes on a Plane, where the idea of it can never possibly live up to the reality of the production. Mm. That was the analogy.
Yeah, I think that's so right. Mm. Snakes in a zip.
Yeah.
Speaking about things you want to quit almost as soon as they start, do you know what time it is? All right, this is the fifth game time of the season. Season scorers currently: Tara 3, value guess 1, Sarah 0. Now, I mentioned earlier in the show that this was sort of a hard scheduled show. We almost ran out of time to do this. So I just want to give fair warning that this is an older game from years and years ago that's been reworked a bit. So if it seems vaguely familiar to you, that is why. Please forgive me. Just ran out of time to like put together something 100% original. So we got a little bit of recycling happening this week on Game Time. And the game time we are playing is Name That Sport. Name That Sport. The rules are very simple. I am going to give you a piece of information about a TV show, and all you need to do is tell me the sport that is involved.
Okay.
1 point for each answer, no hints. All right. So, Tara, can we please get the steel meal situation?
Yes. Sarah has 4 steel meals. I apparently have 5 steel meals, and it looks like the valued guests have 7 steel meals. Oh, I can't remember what happened with steel meals last week, but that is what I have written down.
It was the Khaleesi title.
Of course.
From
that's why.
Emily, who knows her Game
Emily ran the table on Khaleesi titles.
Yes. Okay, so lots of steel meals in play. We have 27 questions for you today. Let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right, Jeff's first, followed by Sarah, then Tara. Right. Are we ready to play Name That Sport?
Roughly.
Here we go. Jeff Drake, simply... The White Shadow. What's the sport?
Basketball.
Basketball is correct. To Sarah. Sam Mayday Malone.
Baseball.
Former pitcher, he of Cheers. Tara. Clear Eyes, Full Hearts.
Football.
Correct. All right, we now enter our Simpsons portion of the game. Going back to Jeff.
Ooh, you brought me a nacho hat.
Thanks, Ned.
Nacho, nacho man. I want to be a nacho man.
I'm going to go with baseball again.
Football.
Okay.
To Sarah D. Bunting.
For the last time, get rid of those sideburns.
Look, Mr. Burns, I don't know what you think sideburns are, but...
Don't argue with me! Just get rid of them!
I assume that's baseball.
You assume correctly. And for Tara.
Yes.
Would you like to play again? You have selected no.
Lee Carvalho's putting challenge.
Yes. Yes.
That is golf. All right, everybody, it's the second Simpsons question coming at you.
Okay.
Jeff, stupid, sexy Flanders.
Oh, wow.
Your hint is stupid, sexy Flanders. What's that sport?
I'm going to just say roller skating.
The answer is skiing.
Feels like I'm wearing nothing at all. Nothing at all. Nothing at all.
Sexy Flanders.
Yeah.
To Sarah, Quickie Mart Gougers. The Quickie Mart Gougers.
Is that roller derby?
It is on skates. It is hockey.
Mm.
All right, here's our last Simpsons question for Tara. Capital City Goofball.
Baseball.
That is the baseball mascot. Mancini, the mascot's best friend. All right, we now exit our Simpsons portion of the game. Back to Jeff. The show, yes. The League. The League.
Fantasy football.
Correct. Yeah. Sarah D. Bunting. Blue Mountain State.
Blue Mountain State? Basketball?
Football again. Tara. Oh. Caprica Buccaneers.
Oh, no. What was this stupid game called? Some dumb made-up game. Well, oh, wait. I think I remember Triangle.
Oh!
So close.
Steel. Oh. Is it Triangle Ball? Worth it.
Your problem is you're thinking on the 2D plane. You got to extrude that to the third dimension.
Oh, pyramid.
Damn.
Right.
Just like Khan, you need to think along the Z axis.
Right. That's one of many things I need to do like Khan.
This is question 13 back to Mr. Drake.
Yes.
Take the car off the blocks and pull it on around the way. The valleys are hot and the bobbins are round. The way they wear them short shorts is out of bounds.
Oh my god.
You know what that's from?
Vaguely familiar with it. I'm going to say soccer.
Incorrect. That was from 30 Rock. That was tennis. The sport is tennis. That's America. Was it Monday Night Tennis or something like that?
Tennis Night in America. Yeah.
Okay. Sarah D. Bunting, what sport is this associated with?
Football.
Football. You betcha. That's Monday Night Football.
Ah, the footing ball.
Yes. This is for Tara. First of all, who wrote it?
John Tesh.
And the sport it is for?
Basketball.
You betcha.
Nice.
All right.
It's called Round Ball Rock.
It is called Round Ball Rock. Two Dave points. Two Dave points, confirmed. My friend. Okay, this is question 16 for Mr. Jeff Drake. The Geller Cup. The Geller Cup.
Trivia?
Not a sport. Nobody's stealing that one? All right. Tara, for no points.
Touch football.
Touch football from Friends, correct.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting, this is question 17 for you.
Spread Eagle.
We are talking Jason's rehab buddy, Herc. Jason's rehab buddy, Herc.
That's wheelchair basketball?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to give that to you. Kind of, it's quad wheelchair rugby. Yeah, I'm going to give that to you. That's Friday Night Lights. All right, this is question 18, taking us into our score break for Tara. The team that visited both Gilligan's Island and Futurama.
The Harlem Globetrotters of basketball.
You betcha. All right, that is question 18. Let's hear the scores here.
Very close game. I have 5. Sarah has 4. Jeff has 2.
All right, Jeff, we're going to put you into the...
Beep, 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 beep. Equalizer.
I'm sorry. I thought I muted.
Don't be sorry.
That gets a Sarah point.
Good luck, Jeff.
Okay, I just want to, before we go into this... I do just want to
your
say that
a
2 is just a 5 upside down. Anyway.
Okay. True.
Starting you off with classics.
Mm-hmm.
What does the Patty Duke Show's theme song say makes Patty Lane lose control?
Oh, boy.
Because they're cousins, identical cousins, and you'll find.
Boys.
Close.
A hot dog. Part of a
hot
boy.
Hot dog makes her lose control. Damn it.
Sitcoms. What newspaper does Alex read every last word of on Family Ties?
The Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Dramas. What daytime soap dealt with the dirty dealings of 3 Houston oil families?
Daytime soap?
Yeah, daytime soap.
Jesus.
Daytime?
Yep.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, Houston.
This is a spinoff if it helps you any.
Right. It's Houston Sexy Time. No?
It's simply called Texas.
I thought you weren't supposed to talk about your show next year, Jeff.
I know.
The title.
Sorry, I snuck it in there.
All right, you got to get 2 of these last 3. Kids and Games is your next category.
What
storytelling segment of Rocky and Bullwinkle was narrated by Edward Everett Horton?
Fractured Fairy Tales.
Ooh.
Wow. I would have gotten it the other way around, too. So, had you said who narrated Fractured Fairy Tales, I also would have.
Amazing.
Nobody likes a braggart.
Hashtag unhumble brag. Go on.
Stars, your answer will be a celebrity. What Star Trek actor breeds show horses on his Kentucky farm?
William Shatner?
Shatner is correct. And
yay!
Well done, Jeff.
Thank
you. 2 points right. to you.
And now we're back to you for real questions. So here yay. Is question.
Well, 19.
And you have a audio clue. Here it is. What's the sport? Answer anytime you want. Just listen and think about our lives. A little day here. Do you know what sport this is connected to? Jeff Drake.
Do you?
Wow.
Any idea?
Is the chatter I'm hearing you guys, or is it in the clip?
That was Dave.
Let's call it figure skating.
Do you want to hear that clip again? No, just kidding.
No one wants to hear that clip again.
Yeah. lovely little ditty was the Masters theme that they play for golf. Golf, 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 golf. All right, Sarah
Disagree.
D. Bunting, what sport are we talking about here?
Every person dancing.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Timeless Torches.
Cheerleading?
Decent guess. That is from 30 Rock, and that was the basketball halftime featuring the Timeless Torches dance squad.
Apparently a real dance squad. I looked it up for the WNBA team.
Yep. It's called. All right, Tara Ariano, we need the sport mostly associated with this clip.
Parasailing?
I'd accept that.
Oh, I just got it. No, it's fine. That's my answer, but I realize what the real one is.
What
Does
is
anyone
want
to steel meal it?
Sure. I'll steel meal.
All right.
Hi-a-lie.
Hey!
Oh,
correct.
We're like, bye-a-lie.
Or Jeff, the Beacon Hills High School Cyclones.
The Good Beacon luck. Hill.
Probably the toughest one today. Watch the show. You might get it. If not, forget about it. But take a stab.
It's I'll a say professional petanque.
That was Teen Wolf's lacrosse team.
I was very close. It was
lacrosse.
All right. For Sarah D. Bunting, the gang gets invincible. It's your clue.
The gang gets invincible.
Correct.
Darts.
Decent
steal.
Oh, steal from Jeff.
I'm going to say football.
You are going to say football. Why do you say football?
Because it's correct.
Yeah.
But why did you guess
reason.
Football?
Why did I guess football? Because isn't that the episode of It's Always Sunny where they tailgate and Charlie wears the green suit?
That is part that? Of it. The other part yes. of it is it apes the movie Invincible, which is all about that fan who tries to get on the Philadelphia Eagles. Maybe that yeah. was why you got it. Which
is oh, yes, you're right. That yes. is that reason that you just told me. That
the Eagles, you mean?
There you yes.
Eagles.
Guys, we're all tied up.
All right, Tara, you can pull ahead with this, your second to last answer. Mm-hmm. The second spitter theory.
This is baseball.
This is baseball. And that was
the Keith Hernandez loogie on Seinfeld.
That's correct.
Yeah.
All right. So Tara is currently leading by one single point. Everybody's last question coming at you, starting with Mr. Jeff Drake. Identify the sport here.
That was a good game. We all showed up and I'm proud of that.
Coach McGurk, I was just wondering, how come they canceled the game after 10 minutes?
Well, because we were losing by 20 goals, Melissa. It's called the slaughter rule. You know, Melissa, if we played the full game, we probably would have lost by 100 goals.
First of all, do you know that yes. voice?
That's H. John Benjamin.
All right, do you know the show?
It's, what is it, Home Movies?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
All right. From yep. your boss.
Yeah, yeah. Indeed.
All right. So we're gonna send this to him after. What's your answer?
Goals. Goals. I'm gonna go with field hockey.
Oh. All right. The answer was soccer. Sarah D. Bunting, are you ready?
Probably.
Here we go.
We've ever made her watch this one.
I don't know.
Sports ball?
Incorrect. That the answer was partially in there. That was Blurn's ball, as they jazzed up the right. baseball a little bit from Futurama, including the guy at the end who comes onto the field on a giant spider, which is one of my favorite yeah. weird Futurama moments ever. All right, Tara, get this to win the game. All right, what sport is this about?
Lana, we got the face off!
Hooray!
Now, can we please get out of here? Because we are totally vulnerable.
I know, look at our defenders.
He's not talking about the defenders.
The crease, idiots! Guard the crease!
Crease, is this soccer again?
It is not.
Steel.
Oh, steel! Oh, that's how you use a steel wheel. All right, let's do it.
That would be hockey.
No, it's not. You suck.
What?
All right. You're bad at steel wheels. Okay, that was from the Archer Pirate King episodes. That was lacrosse. Lacrosse has two.
Lacrosse has a crease, too?
That seems unlikely.
Lacrosse is basically hockey, but except the ball's out of a box.
So. I should have known.
All right, so score breaks, please, here at the end of regulation, Tara.
Okay, Jeff and Sarah were tied with 5 points each. I had six. Very, very, very good.
Last round was so tight. Oh, Jeff, I thought you had it there. all right, so I have a tiebreaker. We're going to repurpose for a steel meal for future use. I'm going to play a clip. First person to identify the sport, again, the sport, will win the steel meal. Are you ready?
Yep.
Yes.
Basically.
Here we go.
Wow, Greg's really doing great. Naturally. Here's my good luck charm.
Surfing.
Surfing from the Brady Bunch, and Tara gets one additional steel meal to add on top of today's win. Congratulations, Tara.
Well done, Tara.
Tara! Tara.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Grade. We put on our best and favorite vestments for the second coming of Fleabag before going around the dial with stops at Vita, She-Ra, and Quiet Storm. Liana made the successful pitch for Hilda's second episode, The Midnight Giant. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was a winner of this week's slightly recycled Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
It is horrendous, but then it's magnificent.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I look like a pencil.
And Jeff Drake.
This needs to go like cockwork.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grade.
You are a weakie.